Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 91, section 7, which is old single column, page 1000. Okay. There's going to be a little bit of a seeming shifting of gears here, and kind of basically until you get to the end of this section. But and there you'll see kind of why. But as I was about to say, but it isn't as much of a sidetrack as one would think by the title in the midst of this paper about prayer. But, just pause. I'm sure everyone can appreciate that because prayer is such a dominant concept in all religions, it's a word that gets stretched and twisted to refer to pretty much the whole space as religionists see it, and it's going to get caught up. Prayer is going to get caught up in those elements of evolutionary religion where individuals are sort of getting caught up in the energies within themselves. And let me just make that little additional comment up front here about what's common about mysticism on the one hand, ecstasy, and inspiration. How are those three things very much common? No matter how much the devotee thinks that they are trying to leave themselves behind and engage in some transcendent experience, it's all about themselves. Just think about it. Who's having the mystical experience? Who's ecstatic, who's inspired? It's about you and your so-called spiritual experiences. And the ism on mysticism is reminding you of that very directly. So, you'll see as they start out, they're not, these concepts or these domains of human mental endeavor are not utterly devoid of value or innately bad, but they're all without much effort problematic because the self is so involved. It's the same issue as prayer itself, where prayer can become very problematic because it's very difficult for prayer not to be about the self. So the degree to which prayer is potentially problematic because the self is involved, all three of these phenomena are even more problematic because the self is even more involved. Okay. Yeah?
Well, can you have an experience without the self being involved in it?
You can't have a literally an experience which is this interplay between an external fact and yourself, of course. But see, that's, remember, that was the challenge that was being put in front of us with prayer last time is sure, there's no way that you can be doing anything without yourself being involved. That's inescapable. But, you know, to get to that spiritual technique of prayer is to really set aside all consciousness of that self, so that the self is effectively just a mechanism to achieve this deity synchronization. That's why it was called a technique. See, just to how much you want to, you're trying to get the mind to just be this mechanism that will function the way, by grace, it was designed and, you know, and it's allowed to function to connect you to the cosmos. And you're not going to be concerned about how cool the connection is, or wow, look what I'm doing, you know, or anything like that. See, you know, or wow, that's a wonderful thing. To add to my toolbox of experiences, or you know, or anything like that. You're going to try to just be an attunement. And not a self that's up to something. You want to just supply as hands-off a favorable condition to be connected and grown. See, and the more you're thinking about what you're up to, the more you know, you're going to be messing with it. Because none of us are sophisticated enough yet to be very hands-on in this attunement phenomenon. It's, you know, remember how we talked about that with the whole healing thing? The moment that you start thinking about it in scientific terms, even if you're thinking that I'm trying to get my mind to help my body, you're going to be thinking in scientific terms, and you're going to mess it up because you don't know the science. So inescapably, you'll be unfortunately imposing states on your mind that make it either less effective or not effective at all in your efforts to do what you think you're supposed to do. Because none of us know. We're just too immature. All right, so let's just get into this a little bit here. And you'll see that they give us a little preface, like I said, to begin with, properly put it in context, and then they step through each of these issues one at a time. So let's see what they give us up front.
Section 7, Mysticism, Ecstasy, and Inspiration. Mysticism, as the technique of the cultivation of the consciousness of the presence of God, is altogether praiseworthy. But when such practices lead to social isolation and culminate in religious fanaticism, they are all but reprehensible. Altogether too frequently, that which the overwrought mystic evaluates as divine inspiration is the uprisings of his own deep mind. The contact of the mortal mind with its indwelling adjuster, while often favored by devoted meditation, is more frequently facilitated by wholehearted and loving service and unselfish ministry to one's fellow creatures.
Okay, so let's just step through one at a time. A whole bunch of elements that they've put together there. Okay, so they start out, it's like, all right, you got this word mysticism. Let's assume that in a very innocent way, what that word means to you is a technique of the cultivation of the consciousness of the presence of God. Okay. Selflessly oriented like that, upwardly oriented, relatively passive. So you're just the consciousness of the presence. Okay. Okay, you know, it's probably not going to be anything highly problematic. But the ism, like I said, as they're reminding you, it's very difficult for it to stay so benign. And but they, you know, they don't want, you know, it's just like in, you know, setting prayer in general. We were talking about it endlessly last session. Okay, you know, we're going to talk about what prayer could be, that doesn't mean that what prayer has been is bad. Okay, you know, it's not a dichotomy. We don't have to beat up on mysticism or ecstasy. But the more spiritually animated naturally we become, the more these notions have pitfalls. Okay, so they want us to they want to, you know, get us to seriously think about these issues. See, when they said, you know, but when such practices lead to social isolation and culminate in religious fanaticism, they are all but reprehensible. So, on the one hand, benign, on the other hand, you know, well nigh reprehensible. So that's a pretty stark contrast. It can go very unfortunate very easily. Because of, you know, visualize what they're saying there. The bit about such practices lead to social isolation and culminate in religious fanaticism. So, in other words, you're getting very, very introspectively oriented. Okay, you know, so any sort of a healthy outward arrow that would facilitate you being encircuited in some way and greater things passing through you because you're connected into a circuit that comes in, down, out, through you. No, you're flipping the arrow. You're like I said, you're really wanting to I want to have a mystical experience. You could care less about anyone else in existence or anything. It's just, you know, that's the problem. It's like, so you're very turned inward. So social isolation, and then the more you drive that inward and upward in search of something profound, you might succeed and get to the ceiling, pinned to the ceiling in the hourglass analogy of your mind, see, culminating in religious fanaticism. So fixated on what the realitizing influence of your third cosmic intuition up there in the sixth level of meaning, what that does to your zeal, your sixth adjutant. You combine that realityizing and, you know, solidity of that cosmic intuition with that zeal, and if you're totally pinned to the ceiling, so there's no tempering influence from the fourth level of meaning, your scientific consciousness. It's all just, you know, what could have been stable religious consciousness on the sixth level of meaning. You don't get genuine religious consciousness. There is no such thing. There is no such thing as genuine religious consciousness divorced from what's on the fourth and fifth levels of meaning, especially immediately balanced by what's on the fourth, that scientific consciousness. So you don't get that genuine religious consciousness, and you don't just merely aren't just merely zealous. You're fanatical. It turns that zeal into this marauding energy in your mind of fanaticism. So that's. You can just see directly picture that the problem is turning that arrow, you know, so that it's, you know, it's just everything is inwardly oriented, and you know, you cram yourself, you know, into all of the holes in the ceiling that might let the cosmos in and plug them up, and so now it's just you. You've sort of blocked the cosmos out. You've turned your back on the entire external world, right? And you're just in this self-satisfying, tail-chasing state. All right. overwrought, mystic, right, as they're saying there. So you can easily get overwrought, lose all tempering, objectivity. And you're totally closed, but you have this very definitive assumption that you're not closed, that you're totally open now for the first time. You've gotten yourself into this open to the cosmos state, see, when you're actually totally closed. And so when you get one of these vivid islands that you burp up from your subconsciousness, notice the uprisings that they're saying there, okay? You're going to fixate on that, and off you go into unfortunate conclusions about what's happening to you. Okay, so now, they throw in a tempering. It's okay. It's not that, some of the beginning steps to what you were calling mysticism, which kind of doesn't have the ism on it, it's not that some of those meditative predicates, don't help you to technically get to a better relationship to the adjuster. But what's the fundamental problem? Okay, when they continue on there, while often favored by devoted meditation, you have to turn your attention to something besides the arrangements of molecules, obviously, but is more frequently facilitated by wholehearted and loving service in unselfish ministry to one's fellow creatures. In other words, just like we were talking about the final paragraph of the preceding section, to find that striking step with the adjuster that you seek, you can't. The adjuster is only a downwelling, arrow. It's downwelling, trying to be part of that encirclement that flows down and out through you. To strike step with it, you have to get up to the top and orient yourself likewise down and out. Like they're saying. So first you get, you're predicated on the sixth level, loving. Okay? And you are synchronized with the whole of the upper domain. Like I was saying, you're not just the sixth level, so you go fanatical, but wholehearted. Okay? You're setting up this internal objective predicate because you want to have it be a predicate for service out there, unselfish ministry to one's fellow creatures. So you're striking step with that down and out potential of the adjuster. That's how you'll strike step with it. When it's all about you and your self-exaltation in the hopes that you can build a pile of rocks like Orange Man high enough inside of you to get to God, see, you're not going to find the adjuster. You're going to find your exalted self. That peak culminates in self-righteousness, not adjuster attunement. Okay? It's only the humble beginning that culminates in adjuster attunement. So they've said their piece about, okay, it's not innately bad or anything, but they did tell you that it quickly goes to well nigh reprehensible. So maybe that's not, maybe trying to do a better job than some Dark Ages mystic did is maybe not what life is about. Maybe the Middle Ages isn't the answer. Okay? Okay, let's see what they say a little bit more here about mysticism.
The great religious teachers and the prophets of past ages were not extreme mystics. They were God-knowing men and women who best served their God by unselfish ministry to their fellow mortals. Jesus often took his apostles away by themselves for short periods to engage in meditation and prayer, but for the most part he kept them in service contact with the multitudes. The soul of man requires spiritual exercise as well as spiritual nourishment.
to that last line. Yes, you need to seek first the kingdom of heaven and spin it up so that the cosmos comes in and nourishes the upper domain. But that's just the initiation step. The whole point is now to exercise what you've activated. And you exercise it by encircuiting it and flowing down and out to others with what with that personal living philosophy that you've supplied the favorable conditions to be grown in that upper domain. That wholehearted cosmic reflecting state in your in the upper domain of your mind. Yeah, see, and they're you know, very direct to disabuse us of all of our notions that we tend to have that the great religious teachers and prophets of old were extreme mystics. Right? They even like to paint Jesus as a kindly mystic. Absolutely not. Right? The only reason he's writ large in history is because he wasn't merely a kindly mystic. Kindly mystics don't have peace that passes all understanding. They have peace that's very understandable. You cut yourself off from the external world, ta-da! You're peaceful. It's very understandable. So all you know, and it's very difficult. I mean, to not slip back into that mode. Everyone has been so trained to exalt these extreme mental states as being the apex of religious achievement. Okay. I mean, they are definitely spiritual, but they're not religious. Okay. The ism is reminding you that. The ism is telling you it's not religious, but it is spiritual. Right? It takes the full abuse of your spiritualized mind to achieve fanaticism. An animal can't be fanatic. Literally requires the third cosmic intuition to achieve it, but divorced, abstracted from its balance, its symmetry with the other intuitions, and abused, right, to your end. Right? It's all about you and your fanaticism.
Chris?
Yep.
In recent times, we had the whole New Age thing, and it was full of one ism after another that went nowhere.
Right.
Totally.
Right.
Nowhere.
Yeah.
And I got fooled by a little bit of it, but not much. But I am really familiar with so many teachings, so many isms.
Right.
And I don't think a single one went anywhere.
Yeah, and they get to that when they get to this list later in the section that kind of goes nowhere. But there's a there's a million years of humans playing around with themselves, discovering all kinds of curious things that one can do to achieve all sorts of strange states of mind, all of which have been called, closer to God or more genuinely spiritual or whatever. I'll grant you, like I just said, it does technically require a spiritualized mind to do this stuff. But I'm pretty sure that reprehensible spiritual mind is not what these people are seeking. Okay? But that's what they're achieving, like they just said. That is grotesque to use your spiritual gifts for such a completely self-serving, self-centered effort. Yeah. The Universal Father gave up everything, right? That's what it means to be godlike. It's not about you. And if the Father isn't about him and his spiritual experiences. Right? He gave up all external experience so that you could exist. He can't have an interplay between himself and the external world and experience. Right? He had to give up every measure of experience so that we could exist. And then what do we do with that gift? We serve ourselves, right? In mystical, tangents. It's very sad. But, it has its place, in the evolutionary process. But obviously the fact that they would talk very directly like this, they're telling you it's time to start leaving such childish pursuits behind, right? Where's your humility? Where's your duty to the cosmos? Okay, now, besides just the immediacies of mysticism, remind you a little bit more about the basic concept there so that you understand the difference between mysticism and ecstasy and inspiration. Mysticism obviously is based on the word mystery. And the essence of that thought is that there is a divine secret. Okay? In a positive mode, that's why they call the thought adjuster a mystery monitor. It's the divine secret that warns. The monitor part warns. It would seem on its surface that the moment they tell you there's thought adjusters, that should completely validate mysticism, which is all about the divine secret. They just told you there really is a divine secret that lives within you. As we were just pointing out, it's easy to generate false divine secrets through the process that's called mysticism. Burping up a vivid island from your subconscious. So you noticed how they in that first sentence when they said overwrought mystic evaluates as divine inspiration. See that divine inspiration. I found the divine secret. Because that's the whole point of mysticism. You're seeking the quote unquote divine secret. Now, ecstasy is more superficial. That's just whipping up your emotional energies of your mind. Until you basically no longer function properly and go into a trance-like state, right? You just kind of your mind just kind of freezes because you've whipped it up so much, and you sort of just lose all of the normal integrity and sort of just diffuse out into some sort of a intense bliss state. That makes you almost like you're in a trance. You kind of just, because again, you're so focused on yourself, you go into kind of a trance, you literally kind of separate from the external world, see? Effectively disconnect from the external world when you really whip these internally focused things up to a froth. You lose your connection. You might even, your senses start to fade away and whatnot. Okay, so that's ecstasy. Let's see what they say about ecstasy.
Religious ecstasy is permissible when resulting from sane antecedents, but such experiences are more often the outgrowth of purely emotional influences than a manifestation of deep spiritual character. Religious persons must not regard every vivid psychologic presentiment and every intense emotional experience as a divine revelation or a spiritual communication. Genuine spiritual ecstasy is usually associated with great outward calmness and almost perfect emotional control. But true prophetic vision is a super-psychologic presentiment. Such visitations are not pseudo-hallucinations, neither are they trance-like ecstasies.
Okay. Okay, so again, you see him starting out. They're going to give us as much validity as they can. Okay, religious ecstasy is permissible when resulting from sane antecedents. Okay, and then you say, and then they go, but, dot, dot, dot. Okay, in other words, but mostly it's insane. What's going on? All right, that, like I was saying, you are literally making your mind insane. It's losing all of its normal equilibrium and connectedness and whatnot to achieve this trance-like ecstasy.
Insane means not healthy.
Yeah, right. It's lost all of its normal equilibrium. It's, you know, it's all jumbled up or, you know, way, you know, asymmetric, you know, flying off on a tangent or whatever, right? It's just lost all of its stability. See, genuine spiritual influence stabilizes the mind. See, and this is the opposite. This is a destabilization of the mind in the name of a spiritual achievement. Okay, but why did they say it's permissible when resulting from sane antecedents? Okay, we're limited individuals, especially because we didn't get the biologic uplift like we were supposed to. So if you genuinely achieve a profound synchronization with the cosmos, it's going to hit you with a lot of force. They're not going to fault you if you lose your equilibrium a little bit. We can't handle the fire hose of the cosmos very well yet. Okay, so yeah, that it's understandable that if you genuinely get a profound experience, that it might destabilize you a little bit. But notice how they're encouraging you. Don't a sane a religious experience might imply destabilization, but destabilization doesn't imply a genuine religious experience. That's the problem. Everyone has always assumed, okay, all I have to do is find some technique to destabilize my mind, and now I'm religious. Okay. And you see, right there. Religious persons must not, see, again, the must not regard every vivid island, basically, like we always talking about. And notice how they use that presentiment word, because they want to remind you that the problem, the great problem lies in it's not just feelings. You remember, a sentiment is a thoughtful feeling. You've added some rationalization to the feeling, and now it's a sentiment. And of course, the pre part is, you're thinking you're getting some sort of prophetic vision of what's to come or something, right? What lies before, hence the pre part. So you've got this whole feelingful thought scheme oriented to, what's going to happen next. And you're generating all that, right? You have certain fears about the future or desires about the future, and you whip yourself up into the generation of a manifestation predicated on all that. Like we talked about before, there's all kinds of things you can do to make it appear that you're really being engaged by some external being and stuff like that. But the sure way for you to notice that it's probably not the case is when this supposed very transcendent being, all they're interested in talking about is what you're interested in thinking about and your fears, and if you're worried about chemical catastrophes or nuclear waste, sure enough, this space being that you're communicating with, boy, that's the most important thing on their mind is what about your nuclear waste or something. See, I mean, that's just you. You're generating all that. It's a product of your fears, your desires, your hopes, your dreams.
Don't tell that to the TM.
Yeah, I know. Right? But that's the way it is. And of course, it's again, like we've been reading, The Evolution of Religion, it's what most of religion has been about, right? It's not just New Agers. And it's everyone. Everyone has been fixated on that stuff forever, some way or another. Okay, so when they say, see, genuine spiritual ecstasy is usually is there again because, it's going to be difficult for us to handle the kind of energies. Okay, so, but the genuine part is great outward calmness and almost perfect emotional control. Right? So just, if you want to seek this or to be able to have, to check, did I achieve this? Just ask yourself that simple question, right? Am I manifesting great outward calmness? Not just a little bit, but outer calmness that passes all understanding, okay? Great outer calmness and almost perfect emotional control. If you're flying off, with your tether snipped, no. Okay, and then here's that final sentence. Can't remember how recently we've talked about this specific issue, but there's throughout all of religious history, people have wanted to use the word prophet. The revelation tells us, okay, there is a genuine prophetic phenomenon. But it's very difficult to sort that out because it's so easy for you to generate a false prophet thing, this whole Vivid Island, whatnot. But if it's a true prophetic vision, it is a super psychologic presentiment. Okay, not just above the lower domain, but above the upper domain. It's literally, to be a genuine prophet is to be engaged by someone genuinely outside of your mind, right? By a separate being, really, not just apparently, right? In your, from your perspective. Only then is it genuinely a prophet. If it's truly super above psychologic, above the upper domain. See, and then they say again, how easily you can be fooled. Such visitations are not pseudo hallucinations. Remember, the word hallucination is basically literally false prophecy or confused prophecy. It's kind of the literalness of the word. Okay, the pseudo part there is, okay, we're not talking about, I'm seeing pink elephants, or something, flying. Okay, not that kind of straightforward, literal, direct hallucination, but this thing that's basically like that, that's generated not seeing, non-existent external material objects, but, thinking that you're being contacted by, a brilliant evening star or something. Or even your adjuster. Yeah. Your adjuster is, even though it's within your mind, it's a separate self. Right? So it kind of falls into this same sort of mode, like a genuine prophet. Right? To be contacted by a separate self, not just generate a false self within yourself.
Okay. It kind of goes then without saying that. If it's a true prophetic visitation, it has nothing to do with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it would have to be because you're in a position to voice that, and most of us aren't.
Yeah, and in some way, they've found an individual that to some degree can be passive enough about this that they can be utilized for some end. The end might be very short term, so the person doesn't have to hold together very long. so maybe they don't have to find someone that can hold together for a long time before it all goes to their head and becomes a, you know, something that they start to add to and self-generate and whatnot. But, you know, Tenskwatawa, they tell you, you know, was a genuine prophet, but, you know, I'm sure it kind of went to his head and, you know, and he didn't stay very focused for very long. You know, it's very difficult to find someone like a contact personality that you can get to be sublimely disinterested for an extended period of time, and just totally allow their mindful self to be used as a mechanism, you know, while they just lay there and count ceiling tiles. Okay, that's difficult to find someone like that that doesn't go, "Ooh, I want to play too." Right, and then it's messed up. Okay, but so they're not pseudo hallucinations, and you know, neither are they trance-like ecstasies. Again, to come back to the ecstasies. All right, so you can see that even though they're being gracious to a degree, bottom line is, okay, guys, you just got to drop all that foolishness. Okay, it just doesn't get you anywhere. Okay. I mean, if you're ready to not be treated with kid gloves, right? That's the bottom line. Yeah, it's a go nowhere thing. It's not going to produce anything. You know, it might, in a very timid sense, produce something in spite of. Remember, they tell you that in other spots when they're talking about this. In spite of all your grotesque desires, you know, there was something positive done with it, but. Why make the cosmos have to work against, you know, what you're doing? Why not supply favorable conditions to be used instead of unfavorable conditions? I mean, if all you supply is unfavorable, the cosmos will do what it can with unfavorable conditions. But sure would be a lot better if you supplied favorable ones. And mysticism pursuits and ecstasy and inspiration notions, that's not favorable conditions. Okay, what do they say about inspiration here?
The human mind may perform in response to so-called inspiration when it is sensitive either to the uprisings of the subconscious or to the stimulus of the superconscious. In either case, it appears to the individual that such augmentations of the content of consciousness are more or less foreign. Unrestrained mystical enthusiasm and rampant religious ecstasy are not the credentials of inspiration, supposedly divine credentials.
Okay, so you can see, you know, when they start out and they say so-called inspiration, and then here, supposedly divine credentials, you know, go back to fetishism, right? I mean, that's, you know, remember, that's where the word comes from, literally inspirited, you know, inspired, right? The belief that this is not me, this is an external spirit that's just come into my consciousness. Because you can see what they just pointed out in that paragraph. Remember, all of us are assuming, to begin with, that our mind is our conscious mind. No, most of your mind is not a conscious domain. Most of it is an unconscious domain, but it's your mind. It's not some, you know, it's not the cosmos's mind. There's a vast chunk that's quasi-separated for you, right, of mind. It's all your mind. No one else gets to play with it. But only a small measure of that whole mindful self is a conscious domain. And so it's almost a given that, you know, you're going to have all kinds of things seemingly coming from outside into that little conscious space and going, "Oh, I've just been contacted by an external being." And no, you know, it's just come from, you know, you've got blinders on, you know, you're looking through a tube. I mean, whatever analogy you want to use here, tunnel vision. No, it's just it's something that's come in from your subconscious or your superconscious. Like if you want to use that analogy, you know, make your mind a cylinder, your entire mind a cylinder with a top and bottom cap, circular cylinder. Okay, and your consciousness is a thin little slice in the middle. And then the whole vast region above that is your superconsciousness, and the whole vast region below that is your subconsciousness. Many, many, you know, so your consciousness is a small percentage of the whole cylinder. And
why
stuff
can do it that way? Does that do us any good? I mean, if we can't realize it because it's not conscious?
Imagine if you were really intensely conscious of all the lower parts of your mind that are keeping your body in shape.
Mechanical.
Yeah. You know, all you'd have to do is just get on your, you know, when you're on your little kicks and you'd totally mess up your whole body. The whole lower domain kind of needs to be out of sight, out of mind, so you don't mess it up.
Almost automatic. So
now, there are people with, you know, desires to become very spiritual who work on figuring out how to really get conscious control down to the mechanical level, and they can change their body temperature and stuff like that, sit in the snow and melt the snow around them, you know, the the Himalayan trick. The whole point is that's supposed to be mostly out of sight, out of mind. So your body, you know, you don't want to be, I think I'm going to mess up the way protein production is happening in my cells. No, that wouldn't be a good thought for you to have.
And you're saying that's all happening through mind.
Yeah, your body, your body is completely controlled by your mind. Right down to the minute, you know, all the stuff that's going on in your mitochondria, right, is all being, you know, coordinated by mechanical mind. Matter doesn't do any of that stuff by itself.
Even when you're an infant, so to
speak. Yeah, even when you're a single-celled organism, right? You've got mechanical mind and first adjutant mind. You know, as a single cell, there's a consciousness in that single-celled human, because it's not just mechanical mind. You know, it's got first adjutant mind. So that first adjutant mind can be aware of the mechanical mind below. There's a differential, so there's consciousness. A plant only has mechanical mind. So there's no differential, there's no consciousness. There's no place to stand and look down on mind and be conscious. There's just one level, mechanical mind.
And then the other half, which is above the conscious part.
All right, then the whole superconscious domain, which, you know, if you go to the hourglass analogy, which, remember, don't confuse the two. It's not like the upper domain is the superconsciousness and the lower domain is the subconsciousness. It's a totally different analogy. The super and sub is all you know, blended together in the hourglass analogy. Those are levels of meaning, not levels of consciousness, in the hourglass analogy. But obviously that upper domain in the hourglass analogy, where the adjuster is, that's likely to be mostly a superconscious domain, you know, in the other analogy. The cylinder analogy.
So as humans progress, you know, as a species, do they become more and more aware of a broader range of consciousness, so to speak? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So it is attainable. So it's,
The
genetics aren't there in our case, but...
Yeah, and it's... If you're a three-brainer...
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that... you know, that you have kind of a separate lower brain to handle all the basic bodily, you know, issues, and you know, so if nothing else, that allows a greater range of consciousness without stumbling into messing up with body issues. That the two brains can work on material consciousness and spiritual consciousness above, and not be messing up the bodies, you know, basic functioning. But the more human, you know, way in deep enlightened life, yes, humans will have, you know, less of their mind will be unconscious domains.
Okay.
Right, the sphere of consciousness, or whatever you want to say, or if you're in the vertical analogy, that slab of consciousness, you know, will get thicker and thicker. There's always going to be some little bit at the bottom, you know, that's unconscious.
So
you know,
they say Jesus reached mastery of his mind, you know, in his later years. Is that what they're talking about?
That's part of it, but again, Jesus was limited by our genetics. You know, he basically had our kind of genetics, which is so distinctly limited. He could only go so far in expanding how much of his mind was a conscious domain, because of that limitation. But see, so it's you can get to first circular and not have to get to full consciousness in your mind or self. You know, they're separate issues. Anyway, back to this. So you've got this, you have this, all this vast parts of unconscious mind from which stuff can enter the conscious view. You know, it's kind of, you know, the Flatlander analogy you see is kind of similar too, right? You've got all this stuff going on out above and below Flatland. The Flatlanders are clueless, but if something enters, you know, if the, like the sphere passes through Flatland, the Flatlanders think that they've had a divine bestowal, that you'll do the exact same thing, like they're saying, right? You know, you'll be certain that it's not you, that it's come from some divine space. So it's that's the whole, you know, it doesn't mean that there aren't spirit ministries engaging our minds, and like in the hourglass analogy, making that upper domain spiritualized mind under the immediate influence of spirit ministries, spirit energy ministries. So it's spiritualized mind. And you can use inspired in a metaphoric sense, right? Basically, in the sense of, I'm actually using my spiritualized mind. I'm using my insights, say, and go, aha, I get it. Or, oh, now I see. You could say you were inspired there. In other words, you used the Holy Spirit. But, you know, you got to be careful not to slip into the fetishism, you know, and think in the old mode of, I can't have such a thought myself. I must have been touched by an angel.
So
or something.
What they mean when they say trust everything beyond the dead.
Yeah, beyond the dead center, right? That, you know, that dead center, you know, like dead level. I mean, like, think of that consciousness. It's a very, very thin sheet of consciousness. You know, that dead center of that little thin sheet. Just trust the rest of it. When your consciousness is expanded, it will be naturally grown. Don't try to build it bigger. Trust the stuff that's outside of there to those that know the physics there. The more you try to push your way out of that sheet of proper, stable consciousness you're in right now, the more you're just going to mess it up. If the adjuster's probably delighting that you're staying in your thin little sheet, and then one day you get this great idea that you're going to really try to do something transcendent. And it's been working for 50 years. To try to get a form up there structured just so, and it's going to let go of it and let it gently float down in there. But then you poke up there and go, pfft, and 50 years of effort evaporated in an instant. And it's like, okay, I'll start all over again. Trust, see, that's what they mean by that trust. Don't mess around where you shouldn't be right now. You're just going to mess it up. There's no way you're going to make it better. The adjuster knows a lot more about mind physics than you do.
So you trust it just when you become unconscious.
You
do that too, but still, it doesn't mean.
Stay within yourself. Don't get overwrought. See, don't get over your skis or whatever analogy you want to use. Yeah.
So as babies and as kids growing up, do we kind of grow through? I mean, that's where you're conscious of the unconscious then. I mean, when you're a baby, that's sort of like being unconscious.
Yeah, okay, yeah. The other thing about that cylinder analogy, that one allows you to kind of visualize sort of directly a little bit of maturing. that level, that thin little sheet. It might not be getting thicker, but it does elevate. And so when you're really young, it's down there a lot closer to your brain. You know, and as you mature, that thin sheet is up a lot higher. That allows your conscious mind, as limited as it is, to be more stable. If it's bounded away from the divots of your genetics down there, but if your conscious level is right down close there, you know, it's in all the turbulence of the mind that's flowing across this rocky, you know, genetics you've got, you know, and it's just being buffeted constantly. So, you know, it's important to allow yourself to be grown, to allow that conscious level to be elevated.
Yeah.
So you're more stable.
Does that relate to why we don't remember being babies? Or
and that's young? Yeah, that has a lot to do with. You don't have access to the memories down there because they're attuned to the mind down there, and you're not conscious of the mind down there anymore. But you know, we all know there's techniques of getting you kind of connected to some of those things that you're not currently conscious of. You know, not to mention I'm recording almost everything right now, but I'm not going to remember it. And one of the reasons is kind of just most of that is just so basal. I mean, I'm up at a higher level of consciousness, so it just I don't have any immediate access to such very material, matter-of-fact stuff that my mind is engaging.
Recording everything what?
You know, I mean, all of the, you know, you're basically remembering what everything looks like in the room. And, you know, I mean, you have a vast ability to store stuff, but you have a limited ability to, you know, to access it.
How is it stored?
In your brain. You know, your brain is a storage mechanism. You know, and it's not just 64 gigabytes. Okay, it's a vast storage mechanism. It can store a lot of stuff. Yeah. So there's just tons and tons of stuff being stored by the brain. And you know, see, most of it you'll never actually use consciously, but it's all there. Your dream life might grab a hold of some of that stuff to build objects in your dream life. Yeah. Right. Lots and lots of raw material that your subconscious can draw from to build dream constructs.
Vivid, detailed.
Yeah.
That should suggest to you what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I read where there's less than a dozen people in all the world who can remember everything of every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That feels more like a shackle.
Mm-hmm.
A shackle that right. Has a liberating.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, oh boy, I wish I was had. Yeah, full ESP where I could hear the thoughts of every person on the planet. No, you don't. Right. Right. You instantly go insane. You're far from ready to plug into the universe broadcast circuits. And give me access to 100 quintillion thoughts simultaneously. No, maybe not.
Yeah,
I don't know about you, but I have a hard enough time just keeping this one mindful self kind of focused and achieving something before I get distracted by something or other.
But there are beings with those kinds.
Yeah, there are beings that can take and what we would consider an infinite number of inputs and handle them all with pure sanity, you know, process them all, synthesize them all. Right, the creative mother spirit is aware of every single animal and human in the entire local universe, every thought in every mind. From the bottom, the lowest thoughts to the highest thoughts, every single, all of your unconsciousness, she's completely conscious of.
All at once.
All at once. Every amoeba, every lizard, every bird in the entire local universe.
Send them
a line, I think
she has. Wow.
Yeah.
Why weren't crazy? Just kind of trust.
Yeah.
So the infinite spirit is even more.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's just a local one.
Right.
Really.
Right. The absolute mind, you know, literally is conscious of an infinite number of things, not just quasi-infinite, literally an infinite number of things. Yeah. So yeah, it's just, you can't even begin to wrap your mind around a mind like a creative mother spirit, and that's nothing compared to greater minds.
Wow.
It's just, right. Just,
you think a finaliter mind is pretty interesting too, I'll bet.
Right, a finaliter mind is a pretty, it's so completely beyond our imagination. What we can hold in our minds, how much interface we can handle without being overwhelmed.
But they started with that same literal potential that we have.
Yeah, yeah. Start small. See, and again, you have value because of what your potential is, not what your actuality is. Because your actuality is negligible. It's irrelevant. You don't want to be measured by your actuality, okay? You'll fall way short. Okay. But even as limited as we are, like get back to the topic here, don't underestimate how fancy just a little bit of limited mind is. Mind is very fancy stuff, right? Again, I mean, think about, an insect, right? And all the fancy stuff that does. You know, just that little bit of first adjutant mind engaged to that insect or that collection of insects. And they do all this fancy stuff, right? Which, if you thought they were just matter, would be utterly magical. I mean, is a beehive not magical if you assume it's purely material? Okay. Right? I mean, it certainly is a lot more magical in my thought about, pouring the bucket of marbles on the floor and leaning back and watching them pile up into a pyramid and saying, I have magic marbles. I mean, look at a beehive, okay? And that's nothing. All right. I mean, mind, even a little bit of mind from a material perspective, purely material perspective, is utterly magical what it does. All of the things that are going on in my mind, in my body right now, that's, they're being kept just so by mind. Every single cell is being tended to by my mind. Right? All of those processes, every single cell is like an entire vast factory. Right? It takes dozens and dozens of humans to oversee a factory. Right? You've got, how many of those factories do you have in your body? You got a lot of cells in your body. Your mind is carefully tending to every single one of them. You don't even have to think about it.
Right. They want your mind to be occupied with something else, like what's going to elevate you to being godlike.
Yeah.
The cells are just in service to that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, just, would you make any spiritual progress if you had to keep track of the doings of every cell consciously? No. Right. I mean, it's hard to have any time to think about spiritual things if you just have to, figure out how to get food and keep the hordes from killing you. And, right, getting to the material comfort era, right, is so that humans can finally have time for something else besides just the basic material stuff. All right. Okay, so that's what's going on with inspiration. Yeah, bringing us back from our long circuitous journey here. So like I was saying, the whole point is, you'll be unwittingly intrigued by inspiration because of your natural tendency to think fetishistically. It's like, ooh, I want to think that I'm inspired. And just ask yourself, why do I want to think that? It's because of fetishes. Thinking fetishistically is natural, like we studied. And so you just can't help but kind of get caught up in that sort of mode, and a little bit of thinking about, ooh, I'm inspired, you know, that you follow that, and the next thing you know, you're having trance-like ecstasies, and then you're a lifelong devotee of self-serving mysticism. And it just doesn't go anywhere. So stop it before it takes off. Okay, now here's that list I was telling you about. And, you know, read the preface, and let's do the items in the list one at a time, and I'll just make quick comments about each one.
The practical test of all these strange religious experiences of mysticism, ecstasy, and inspiration is to observe whether these phenomena cause an individual, one, to enjoy better and more complete physical health.
So there you can just focus on that. It's like, well, what about item number one? Am I so fixated on my, finding an ever more ecstatic spiritual experience that I haven't bathed in weeks, and all I eat is Cheetos, or whatever. Yeah, right. Not to mention all of the interesting substances that you might be taking to foster these experiences. Right. Yeah. Are you enjoying better and more complete physical health? You know, really, not delusionally. Oh, those whatever I'm taking, that makes me healthier. No, not really. Okay, so there's that simple health thing, physical health. And as soon as you see the word health now, you should always think in the triunity. So you're thinking about true health. Right. Health doesn't stand by itself. It stands in a triplet, a triunity. Health, sanity, and happiness. I already mentioned sanity. Right? So very fact that so many of those things are an insane state of mind means you can't be genuinely healthy because mind dominates matter. If your mind is in an insane state, your body is going to suffer. It can't do anything else. It's a helpless victim to your mind. Yeah. All right.
Two, to function more efficiently and practically in his mental life.
Okay, now besides the immediate sanity issue that I was just talking about with number two, the key thing to note there is like, oh, in other words, not a visionary, right? To function more efficiently and practically in your mental life is to not be a visionary. The visionary is a negative word, which is the opposite of number two. That's what that word visionary refers to, an impractical state of mind. Okay, you're off in these tangents that these strange religious experiences, as I said, there have taken you. You know, you think it's genuine visions from divine visitations or whatever. Okay, but no. So
visionary doesn't mean not life planning.
See, that's the thing. We I've said this many times. Look up the word visionary in the book. It's not a positive word. It doesn't matter that humans use it for nothing but a positive word now. Look it up in the dictionary. It's a negative word that we're corrupting. Because again, we want to be inspired. We want to be a fetish. We want to be a visionary. It's just, see, the very fact that we are forcing the word to have its opposite sense is this primitive quest for these strange religious experiences that are a natural thing. If your animal wants to go this way, you have to pull back on the animal's reins and say, no, you don't want to be a visionary. Oh, but I love the word. It sounds so cool. If I could only be a visionary. Yeah, if you could only be hopelessly impractical and of no use to anyone. Because it's all about you. See, what you want to be is far-seeing. Oh, that sounds so practical. Oh, yeah, see, that's the thing. You're grounded. You're actually, you know, focused on wholehearted and loving service and unselfish ministry to one's fellow creatures instead of just you and your fancy thoughts and your beliefs about yourself. I'm a visionary.
But people also use that word for insightful or far-seeing.
I know. That's my whole point. But it's inappropriately used that way, see?
So you should use the other words instead.
Yeah, you see, that's the challenge. To not slip, you know, we're just slipping back into fetishism and everything. The very fact that we could not hold that word in its coinage and we wanted to flip it into a positive word. That just shows you that there's an emergency. Everything is falling back.
The number two makes me think of the benefits that I experience from mindfulness practice.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take the religious part out of it, but mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. the practice part,
right,
to get you to be more in the moment and more observant.
See, it's technically that mindfulness stuff is to try to get you to be more sane. The incessant clamoring actually is trying to drive our minds insane. That's the natural tendency of your mind is to be driven insane. That's why you're given a seventh adjutant and encircled in the Holy Spirit. If all they did is give you six adjutants, give you one more adjutant to make you super animal, give you a sixth adjutant, that's an unstable mind. It's innately unstable. That sixth adjutant takes that incessant clamoring and just drives the mind insane, drives it into an unstable state. Okay? So, all right, all that mindfulness, all these sorts of things are trying to you know, to actually focus on what keeps our mind sane. Okay? All right, why don't we just keep going.
Three, more fully and joyfully to socialize his religious experience.
Okay, you know, I don't have to say much there, but she, you know, that, again, that's just reminding you of that, not having it all focused about you, right? But to keep yourself oriented to being part of an encircled phenomenon that benefits those around you. It's not all about you.
Four, more completely to spiritualize his day-by-day living while faithfully discharging the commonplace duties of routine mortal existence.
Okay, now that one just allows you to focus on more completely to spiritualize his day-to-day living. What does that mean? If it doesn't mean taking yourself off on all these mystical tangents or something, okay, what does spiritualize mean? What that fundamentally means is you're going to use spirit over mind, your free will, to keep that upper domain, your genuine inner life, in a state that you choose that's independent of the external world. If you spiritualize your day-to-day living, what you have a stable, cosmically reflecting upper domain that's the predicate for everything you do down and out. It doesn't matter if what's happening in the external world is pleasant to your lower domain or not pleasant to your lower domain. The upper domain is the same. It has so you respond with the same predicate. That's spiritualizing your day-to-day living. Having that constant, stable predicate for everything you do. So if things are going very, very well, you don't get so caught up on it that it carries you off on a silly tangent, you know, and you do something you regret because you were just so beside yourself with delight or whatever. You know, you stay grounded. And it's, and of course, if things are very difficult in the external world, you can deal with it. Right? You know, you've got this stable predicate. You have that peace that passes all understanding. Everything's going to hell in a handbasket. Everything is going to hell in a handbasket, but you're okay inside. You're stable. That's what that's about. More completely, to have that unshakable predicate, using spirit over mind, to have a part of your mind that's not a helpless victim of the external phenomena. Okay. It does, you know. But see, most people think of more spiritualized means that you're more and more a helpless victim, right? That you feel things more deeply when they happen in the external world. That's a more spiritual person. No, that's the opposite. That's a less spiritual person. That's a more feelingful person. But it's a you only can be more feelingful like that by being less spiritual. Right?
And that's not long-suffering either, right?
I mean, well, long-suffering is, I mean, your lower domain is having lots of issues. But the upper domain is saying, okay, no, let's take the long-term view here. Right? Yes, it's very difficult right now. And you're aware of that. You're suffering. But you can handle it. Take the long-term view. You know, it'll come out on the other side. If nothing else, there's the next life. Okay?
Most of us, if we have ideals, want to realize these ideals in this life.
Yeah.
But life gets in the way. You know, and we have to do... Instead, we find ourselves dealing with all of these other things. But that's what I hear this speaking to. To do all these other things joyfully and with putting the spirit to work in my everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's nothing that's going to ring bells in the universe, but, but it takes care of things that need to be taken care of.
Yeah, it just and even the simple thing of, you know, the commonplace duties of routine mortal existence. If you have that solid inner life, it won't be so difficult for you to wash the dishes and mow the lawn. Okay, you won't feel like I'm wasting my life. It's like, no, you know, that stuff runs parallel to a part of you that you know, where you know you aren't wasting your life. You know, that upper domain that you've taken a delight in cultivating is going on, and you're not wasting your life. You're something significant. You will begin to understand who you really are, and you won't feel so much tension. It's like, I'm not really someone who mows the lawn, you know. You know, there won't be so much unfortunate tension with those mundane things anymore.
We're meant to deal with all that stuff, and I like dealing with it. Like, I get up and do chores. It grounds me. Mm-hmm. I think it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's only for this lifetime, so we might as well enjoy it. Oh, I will have chores on the man.
We'll always have duties. This Vernage would take care of a lot of things on the mansion world. So.
We'll have slave labor.
All right. What's number 5 here?
5. To enhance his love for and appreciation of truth, beauty, and goodness.
Okay. So now that one, we'll get to more of that in the next section. How that fits in. So I'll just you know, wait until we get to that in the next section to comment a little bit more on that.
6. To conserve currently recognized social, moral, ethical, and spiritual values.
This is a big one. Okay, when you're so fixated on those spiritual but not religious things, like I was saying, of mysticism, ecstasy, inspiration, all these self-serving efforts in the end, that will naturally get you to favor what you imagine the progress angels are up to. And you won't really care much for those religious guardians, those master seraphim, right? The master seraphim job that are called the religious guardians is exactly what it says in number 6, to conserve currently recognized social, moral, ethical, and spiritual values. That's their job. That's a religious job. Just being all about progress, that's when you're spiritual and not religious. Because where does progress come from? Where's the potential of progressibility? The value of life is its progressibility, right? That potential is in spirit. And if you just fixate on the spirit, divorced from an encompassing personal wholeness, you get very fixated on progress. You eventually ideologically become a progressivist. And, you know, as we've talked about before, they may just call themselves progressives, but no, they're an ism. They're a progressivist. They have the notion is just about progress, and they don't care if anything is conserved. Matter of fact, they probably think conserve is a negative word. You know, and that's basically because they think it's the word preserve. No, it's the conserve is the opposite of preserve. You know, so they're that confused that they don't even distinguish between opposites. You know, preserve is oriented to the past. Conserve is oriented to the future. It's opposite. That's why they bring that one in. See, that's exactly to what I was, you know, bringing up earlier about, yeah, it's spiritual.
It would be driving in the wrong direction.
Okay. You're going to get, you know. See, there's a reason why the progress angels need checkmates. Because if you just focus on sort of depersonalized spirit, and hence progress just, you know, in and of itself, okay, that's, you know, no, there has to be a bridle put on that, right? There has to be a personal nature that controls that spiritual energy. So the religious guardians are checkmates, not just checks, but checkmates for the progress angels. So just notice that. Just have the courage to admit to yourself, yeah, I've always favored the progress angels over the religious guardians. Yeah, I have a tendency to be spiritual but not religious. Just be willing to admit that to yourself.
But the religious guardians need the progress angels too.
Of course, everything needs its place. But it doesn't mean that you should somehow, it's like, necessarily change what you are, but you do recognize that you may need to have other people to help balance you out, because you could easily get too fixated on progress to the expense of conservation. Yeah. All these things, you know, we all have genetic tendencies, and the degree to which we can't be holistic within ourselves, we need to work with others so we balance ourselves out and don't, you know, if everyone that's kind of like inclined like that all pools together and then takes over the world, okay, well then we're going to have an interregnum, because that's why there's an emergency. It's because there's less and less of a religious bridle on the spiritual energy, and we're not conserving anything. We're losing everything. Okay, that's the emergency situation. All right.
7, to increase his spiritual insight, God consciousness.
So the fun thing there is just parenthetically, the God consciousness, like, even to the heights of God consciousness, right? I mean, so increase basically has no limits. You can't even imagine God consciousness. So, right, there's always more to go. But with these self-serving modes, notice how that it doesn't have you on that track. It's, you know, you discover some technique of mind game, and then you just want to build a tabernacle and stay there forever. You don't have this humble, ever-increasing line of growth that you're on. So all of those that give you various ways to kind of to consider, like you were saying early on, all these isms, do they really take you anywhere? Do they really, you know, improve, you know, the world, or is it all just ends up being self-serving and hence kind of self, you know, imploding, destructive? You know, it's very difficult for those groups of people to not start tearing at each other.
They sold a lot of books, though.
Yeah, yeah.
There's not that much value in it, really. They might have made money, but they are imploding.
Yeah, right. Right. Again, because it's just, it's not keeping the self guided in productive paths. It's allowing the self to be too aggrandized, and that just never works well. Okay, then prayer. They're going to say something about prayer. Finally.
But prayer has no real association with these exceptional religious experiences. When prayer becomes overmuch aesthetic, when it consists almost exclusively in beautiful and blissful contemplation of paradisiacal divinity, it loses much of its socializing influence and tends toward mysticism in the isolation of its devotees. There is a certain danger associated with overmuch private praying, which is corrected and prevented by group praying, community devotions.
So I kind of gave all that up front. See, like they said at the very last sentence, we know there's this certain danger associated with prayer because it's self-reminding innately, so it can get too introspective. But it's even worse if you start using the word praying or prayer as a word for all of these mystical sort of pursuits. Because those are very self-oriented. So that's why they said, tell you in that first sentence, see, but prayer has no real association with these exceptional religious experiences. Doesn't matter how many people in the Middle Ages said it did, okay? It doesn't. It appears to be associated, but it isn't really. See, there's no real association. They spend all this time talking about mysticism, ecstasy, and inspiration because there's no way we can improve prayer if it's all balled up in that stuff. So you need to definitively separate prayer from that. Okay, and then we can focus on the limitations of early prayer where it's mostly just a psychological procedure, and we can think about trying to get it to be, in addition, eventually a spiritual technique that'll help lead us up as individuals towards true worship. Okay, so when all is said and done with this, that's that you can see now what the point of all this fixation on this was. It's basically so that you can better understand what the word prayer is appropriately applied to. In other words, it's been misapplied, and I use that wrong misprefix purposely. It's been misapplied throughout a lot of religious history. You're really going to mess up prayer if you think it's like the essential essence of mysticism or something.
I don't think most people realize that.
Yeah.
Do you?
No. Well, I mean, I do now because of the revelation.
No, most people don't.
Yeah. No.
They talk to. I mean, and they're sincere.
Yeah, they're very sincere. And like I said, as long as they don't overplay it, it's probably mostly harmless. But they're going to just kind of spend their whole life, you know, playing with their belly button lint, you know, and they're going to wake up on the first mansion world and recognize, wow, I didn't really do much but, you know, stare at my navel, did I? Yeah, so.
Our thought is worship self-forgetting.
Worship is self-forgetting, yes. Okay. Yeah. You know, and the curious thing is you have to lift prayer up, making it less and less about the self, and eventually it can smoothly transition into that self-forgetting state of worship. You know, when there's just sort of the tiny little bit of the essence of the self in that self-remindedness of the at the peak of prayer, you can let go of that and go to the self-forgetting mode of worship. But it's very difficult to let go of the self when it's the incessant clamoring down at the bottom of the ladder. It's hard to even stay on the bottom rung of the ladder. So you slowly wean yourself off of yourself, basically through prayer, to the point where, you know, at least for a while, you can trust that yourself is okay, turn your back to it, and focus on attuning to the cosmos, synchronizing to the cosmos, and being in a state of that attunement, that worship. Yeah. Okay, now this, we should be able to get through this. We'll leave the final section about the conditions of effective prayer till next time. But and most likely we won't have time for it, but... But let's kind of get the predicate of it a little bit here.
Section 8, praying is a personal experience. There's a truly spontaneous aspect to prayer. For primitive man found himself praying long before he had any clear concept of a God. Early man was wont to pray in two diverse situations. When in dire need, he experienced the impulse to reach out for help. And when jubilant, he indulged the impulsive expression of joy.
Okay, so they're going to give us a little bit of a synopsis here about prayer in this section. So they want to remind it, remember how we started out, you know, even talking about in the whole sacrifice mode and all that sort of stuff, how there's that the twofoldness. There's the whole debt mode on the one hand, and then the whole thanksgiving mode on the other hand, or the gift mode on the other hand. So they're reminding you of that twofoldness. Do you feel in debt in some way, and that's why you're praying, or do you feel thankful, and that's why you're praying? Okay.
Prayer is not an evolution of magic. They each rose independently. Magic was an attempt to adjust deity to conditions. Prayer is the effort to adjust the personality to the will of deity. True prayer is both moral and religious. Magic is neither.
Okay, so obviously that paragraph, it's kind of like the preceding section, trying to remind you what prayer isn't, so that you can focus on what prayer is, even if it's primitive, what prayer is. Saying it directly, it's not an evolution of magic. Okay, what's between the lines of that? Unfortunately, that's what most people think of prayer as. It's just the current name for magic. We think we've left magic behind, but we just call it prayer now. Because, right, see, it says magic was an attempt to adjust deity to conditions. And for most people, prayer is an attempt to adjust deity to conditions. God, can you please help me with this, you know, that and the other thing. Trying to get deity into your service. You know, it doesn't have to be as crude as a parking spot. But here's where, you know, we were just talking about being able to move up So the self is diminished as you move up the ladder of prayer. Remember what they said about getting to that spiritual technique. Back there a couple sections, and it said, when the prayer seeks nothing for the one who prays, nor anything for his fellows, then such attitudes of the soul tend to the levels of true worship. So, we're in such a mode of thinking of it basically in magical terms, and even if we improve it and it's, we're not seeking anything for ourselves, we're still most likely seeking something for our fellows. See, and that's us talking to ourselves like that, desiring aid for our fellows. That's the psychologic procedure. Procedure to go forward. You're kind of getting stuck in your concerns and fears about, your relative or your fellow man. There's so much war in the world or whatever. And so you pray as a psychologic procedure to try to get you unstuck and get you to go forward again. Proceed, right? That's the psychologic procedure, and it has great benefit, like we talked about. But just don't ever forget there's another higher mode to prayer. It can be a spiritual technique also and can culminate in true worship. But all that psychologic procedure stuff is just there on the bottom rung of the ladder, trying to keep you from getting stuck and going catatonic with fear, for instance. Yeah.
Do you find that when you pray for other people, though, it does help you be more, do unselfish service?
Yeah.
Which, I said earlier, I forget exactly where it was, they were talking about it's more frequent facilitated by whole lives.
Oh, yeah.
Loving service.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
It's like that's a real thing.
Yes, it is a real thing, and it needs to happen.
It seems to.
You need that psychologic procedure. So you're not going to throw away the psychologic procedure. You're going to improve the psychologic procedure. You're definitely going to divorce it from magic. You're going to divorce it from mysticism and whatnot. It can't be a useful psychologic procedure if it's all balled up in mysticism. Okay? You need that psychologic procedure. And on that stable psychologic foundation that prayer is helping you with, you're going to build a spiritual technique. And the moment you lose that psychologic foundation, there goes your spiritual technique. Okay, you've got to keep that psychologic foundation. You need to prayer, if nothing else, to maintain that. But that psychologic procedure is not going to be an end in itself anymore. It's going to be the means to some greater end. To explore this mostly unexplored territory in human history of the spiritual technique of prayer. Okay, let's keep going here.
Prayer may become an established custom. Many pray because others do. Still others pray because they fear something direful may happen if they do not offer their regular supplications.
Okay, so you've got those very, very fear-based mechanical levels, pray without ceasing or we're all going to die. Okay. And again, I mean, mankind would have gone catatonic, ages ago if we didn't have that psychologic procedure. Because there's many things to fear when there's saber-toothed tigers and whatnot and marauding hordes. Not to mention chemical waste and nuclear bombs and what have you. Yeah. What about depleted uranium shells or whatever it is that you're all getting frothy about? One of the things that can help with all that, that's even more powerful than prayer, is just a little reminder that you have 10 mechanical controllers resident on this planet. 10 master physical controllers of that flavor of mechanical controller, I mean, each of which has more power than you can even imagine. I mean, each of those beings can influence the galaxy.
But don't they're not allowed to interfere.
Yeah.
Right. Right. But again, no real harm is going to befall the planet. Okay? One little microsecond of thought and all, you know, nuclear waste disappears. Okay? It's not really an issue. It doesn't mean that we should just throw stuff, you know, all around. And okay. But, you know, we need to be good stewards of the environment. But don't bring the ism thing in. Remembering about the master physical controllers will keep it from going to an ism where you go all humanistic. And it's like, you know, we have to do it, you know. And, no, I mean, there's a God and there's God's hands and it'll all be okay.
But God doesn't prevent us from going to war.
He won't prevent us. No, of course not. Like I said, it's not a dichotomy. We're just trying to keep ourselves from getting all in a panic, right? And having no peace, let alone peace that passes all understanding. I mean, you just say, okay.
What does it matter to a true son?
Right. It'll be okay. You know, like I've tried to remind you, I'm not exaggerating. Literally, if they thought it, the planet would turn into a daisy. They have that much power. That's not a figure of speech. That's literally... Instantly, it would turn into a daisy if they thought it. They manipulate things at the ultimatonic level. They would rearrange all the ultimatons on the planet into a giant daisy if they just thought it. Okay, that's the kind of power they have. You know, little things like that we worry about as being existential crises are not. Okay,
don't slip.
It's gonna be okay.
Don't lose their grip. But on the other side, you know, you use your mind, and, you know, maybe when you read the ranch book and you realize how many times the United States was underwater or above water over 50 million years.
Yes.
Almost 50 times.
Yes.
Now you use your mind and you don't build on a sandbar.
Yeah.
Or you know, right. Prepare ahead of time. You don't get caught like the dinosaurs did.
Right.
You
know, exactly. Right.
Now's the time to buy property in Greenland.
Well, it's melting. Right. It's just right. Trying to take a bigger perspective about these things.
That's why they call it Greenland.
Okay, so that's that first one just gets us off into all those fear-based things. What else do they say here?
To some individuals, prayer is the calm expression of gratitude. To others, a group expression of praise, social devotions. Sometimes it is the imitation of another's religion, while in true praying it is the sincere and trusting communication of the spiritual nature of the creature with the anywhere presence of the spirit of the Creator.
So just see, notice in short little vignettes, They're giving you these contrasts because, like I said, once you free prayer from like the really biggies like mysticism and magic and whatnot, okay, then you're going to refine it, okay, and just continue to compare and contrast and refine what you call prayer. The more you can get it into a Thanksgiving mode, the more it might lead you up to Thanksgiving. And through Thanksgiving to worship. And as long as you're stuck in the debt mode, right, it's not going to get up there. That's a big boat anchor, huh, on prayer. So just all, we don't have to, you know, draw about all the details about all these. It's just notice what they're doing. To some it's this, to others it's that. Okay, one is not bad and the other good. It's an evolutionary thing. It's appropriate to various people at various times in various ways. But it just allows you to reflect on it and think about, well, you know, mine's a little bit too focused on myself. Let me focus on others more or whatever. Just how you can make that, you can improve that psychological procedure. And the more you improve it, the more there's the potential for there to be a spiritual technique built upon that improved foundation.
When you say pray for those who hate you, pray
for it. Right. Yeah. You're destined to lead a mean, narrow life if you only love those who love you in return, right? See, as a parallel to that sort of thinking. Yeah, yeah. It's easy to pray for your best friend. You know, it's not as easy to pray for your most hated enemy. Okay, pick the person you think is the biggest boogeyman on the planet. Pray for that person. All right, because you're stuck there. You need something to help you proceed. Okay, get unstuck from that hatred. So pray for that person. You know, they're haunting you. You're stuck. You
know? Prayer may be a spontaneous expression of God consciousness or a meaningless recitation of theologic formulas. It may be the ecstatic praise of a God-knowing soul or the slavish obeisance of a fear-ridden mortal. It is sometimes the pathetic expression of spiritual craving, and sometimes the blatant shouting of pious phrases. Prayer may be joyous praise or a humble plea for forgiveness.
Yeah, it's always amazing when you see someone doing the blatant shouting of pious phrases mode. So, you know, so loud your ears are bleeding. But I love the first one. It's like, okay, what's the biggest contrast we could draw? Well, the highest thing we could say is God consciousness. And then we'll contrast that with meaningless recitation of theologic formulas, which you could program a robot to do. That one's beautiful. It's like that's like the full differential there. Yeah, if only we had more spontaneous expressions of God consciousness on this planet. Oh my goodness! But notice in the next one they took it down a notch just to God knowingness.
Yeah.
Okay, several notches down to God knowingness. Anyway, again, you just see all the compare and contrast.
Prayer may be the childlike plea for the impossible, or the mature entreaty for moral growth and spiritual power. A petition may be for daily bread, or may embody a wholehearted yearning to find God and to do His will. It may be a wholly selfish request, or a true and magnificent gesture toward the realization of unselfish brotherhood.
It could be the unfortunately translated Lord's Prayer and be for daily bread. Or it could be, forgive us this day our bread for tomorrow, the properly translated Lord's Prayer. Remember that word epiousion that they're translating there? I've mentioned that before. That exists only in the Lord's Prayer, so no one knows what it means. Again, see, just all the compare and contrast. And how, as a little child, what's your plea going to be? It's going to be a plea for the impossible. That's okay. God doesn't hate you because you're a little child and your plea is for the impossible. You're praying. It's a start. But
how often did Jesus say that?
Yeah. But now that you're a little more conscious. Yes.
The whole last paper.
Yeah. Exactly. The faith of Jesus. Yeah. Yeah, but you know, here you can see it's like, okay, that's okay when I was a little child, but you know, maybe I should try to be an adolescent now. I should catch myself when when they're just in these pleas for the impossible. God, please love me more than you love someone else. Okay, that's impossible. Yeah, he literally can't do that. He loves you only absolutely. There's no relativity possible. It's impossible for him to love you more than he loves someone else. It's impossible for him to love you one iota more than that person on the world you hate the most. He loves him exactly the same as you. And can't do anything else. What was that?
The one about finding God and doing his
Yeah, right?
I mean, how do you find God? That's not something you do.
Yeah.
It's done today and gone tomorrow, right?
No, right? Yeah. mean, those fancier, if you will, thoughts about prayer. Notice how they begin to. It's like, well, you know, I've got to kind of stop and reflect a little bit. Okay, yeah. What is it? See, it's helping you with that favorable condition to reflect, and, you know, potentially be grown. Anything that
what
can.
Is God's will really?
Yeah, anything that'll pull back on the reins a little bit helps. Okay. Yep.
Prayer may be an angry cry for vengeance, or a merciful intercession for one's enemies. It may be the expression of a hope of changing God, or the powerful technique of changing oneself. It may be the cringing plea of a lost sinner before a supposedly stern judge, or the joyful expression of a liberated son of the living and merciful Heavenly Father.
Just all these fun contrasts. Like ones where you just, changing, I've got a thought there, but it's not God that needs to change. Oh, I need to change. Maybe I have an unfortunate initial assumption. I should change that. Rather than trying to change God to match my unfortunate initial assumption, how about if I change my initial assumption? That would probably be a better idea.
That's possible.
That's possible. Right. You can't change a changeless fact. That's impossible. No matter how fervently you pray. And you got to love it, too, that capitalized judge, right? Supposedly, or judge.
Yeah.
Who are the capital J judges?
Angels.
The ancients of days, yes. The universal father isn't, but that doesn't mean there aren't capital J judges. Okay. Keep going.
Modern man is perplexed by the thought of talking things over with God in a purely personal way. Many have abandoned regular praying. They only pray when under unusual pressure, in emergencies. Man should be unafraid to talk to God, but only a spiritual child would undertake to persuade or presume to change God.
See, notice what they did at the end there. But only a spiritual child, right? Trying to remind you what the difference is between a spiritual child and a spiritual adult. And a spiritual child would undertake to persuade or presume to change God. Because, you know, what does a child know? They don't know any better. I can cleverly change how mom said, get her to back off of her edict or whatever. And so why can't I change God? So just, you know, those little things, you know, it's purposely, you know, it's spiritual, okay, but it's a child. And that's a beginning, not an ending. God expects you to grow up. Not going to smite you because you undertake to persuade or presume to change him. But, you know, eventually you need to mature, right? And not pray so silly anymore.
This is a key paragraph, though, is the thing about talking things over with God in a purely personal way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's different than prayer to me.
Yeah.
I mean, sharing the inner life with God. I mean, and I, you know, they talk, we've gone through this paper, and it talks about, you know, the alter ego, and then that grows into maybe talking to your therapist or whatever, but... and we should be unafraid to talk with God. And sometimes I get from listening in class here that it's, you know, that it's not okay to try and talk to God.
Right, yeah.
But I think it is probably.
Of course it is, I have to.
I love this movie. Remember the movie called Oh God?
That
John Denver and, what was his name, George Burns?
Yep.
And in the end he says, well, boy, can we talk again? And God says, you talk. I'll listen. Which is exactly what happens. Hopefully you listen.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you didn't talk back usually, at least not direct, you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
But I find it very comforting to talk to God.
Of course.
Long, don't you?
It's the psychological procedure is so important. And now, it has varying degrees of importance for different people, but okay, it doesn't make it bad or, you know, it's very important. So recognize that you need that and pray. Now, you can keep in mind that as the child grows into adult, prayer is going to change.
Yeah, and but personally, to me, talking to God is usually not like if they talk about prayer or asking for something or whatever. It's more just, talking to God. It's more
like talking things over with God.
Yeah, right. As opposed to asking for something to talk about.
Yeah.
Or me or someone else. It's certainly not less sharing.
A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. My tendency, because I know that I can't change God.
Right.
I know that.
Yeah.
So why pray?
Yeah.
It's like, right. That answer.
Well,
you don't pray for that.
It's taking the knowledge and misapplying it.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's like, just because you don't want anything, you're not in the debt mode, are you thankful for something? Tell God what you're thankful for.
Yeah.
Right? It reminds you that you have at least that, what you're thankful for. Everything else might be terrible. Your dog may have just died and whatnot. But, okay, but there's something you can be thankful for.
Yeah. Thankful for being born on the worst planet in the universe. Yeah. Start at the very, very bottom.
Thank you, Doctor.
Anyway. Yeah. No, it's a lot of this, the content of this section is straightforward, but it doesn't mean it's trivial. No, I mean, you should, even though we can kind of read it and get it, just spend some time reflecting on it, okay? Don't just let it go in one ear and out the other. Take one of these little, it's just one tiny little vignette after another, because it's like, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take one paragraph each day, maybe, and I'm going to reflect on just what's in one paragraph, and when I get to the paragraph, I'm going to go back, right? They're giving you these little vignettes to just take a little element and reflect on the, get above it enough that you can genuinely compare and contrast and reflect on it and not be judgmental or anything about yourself or others, but just feel the difference, right? And the more and you start to pick up differentials, like, I know the arrow that goes from childhood to adult. I feel it now. Because there is this tendency for people to existentialize our child of God state. Like I've talked about it. It's like, I'm a child of God. Okay, yeah, to begin with, but not for very long. In short order, you need to become an adult of God. So don't overplay the child of God thing. And it's like, well, what's the difference between a child and an adult? I was kind of making a child everything. So they're, so once you make child, a sub-infinite, so that there's something else, right? You need to figure out what the difference is. So you got to reflect on that.
Jesus isn't sub-adolescent, fond of reciting, I think I'm going to have a little talk with my father.
Yeah.
I wasn't talking about Joseph.
Yeah, see, now in Jesus' case, when you post-baptism, one of the reasons he was leaving, kind of the most rudimentary prayer life behind. Okay, once he's actually fully Michael, okay, he has his Michael connection to the Universal Father. That's kind of transcended to prayer, okay. I mean, he literally has a communication link, okay. So that's another reason why he left prayer behind, by the time he got to the public ministry. But still, as I said, he's mature. You're going to leave a lot of what your prayer life was as a child behind. There's higher things that that you'll call your prayer life, but it'll evolve. You got to let it evolve, and eventually you leave a lot of it behind because you live in a state of worship, not a state of prayer. You solve problems with worship, not with prayer. So, prayer becomes the exception to the worship rule instead of the other way around. Okay.
But real praying does attain reality. Even when the air currents are ascending, no bird can soar except by outstretched wings. Prayer elevates man because it is a technique of progressing by the utilization of the ascending spiritual currents of the universe.
What kind of a technique is it? A spiritual technique. Right. And here they're just reminding you of the literalness of that. Okay. It's a technique of getting you to be something that spirit gravity can grab a hold of. The fancy blob of protoplasm is not going to be lifted up by spirit gravity, okay? So you have to actually spread the wings, right? No, or there's no spirit gravity, you know, engaging you. So that's just reminding you of the literalness of this, that you know, you don't really climb the ladder. You're pulled up the ladder by spirit gravity. Yeah.
Yesterday, I saw some birds in this field. I thought they were, are those chickens or those pheasants? But once they took to flight, I figured, no, they're eagles.
Mm.
And they flapped their wings and got up a little ways, and then they caught this air current.
Yep.
And they just kept going around in circles, but they kept going higher and higher.
Right. Yeah.
It was amazing to watch.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and that, so they give you that analogy because it's very, very appropriate. You know, kind of the exhilarating feelings of the beauty and majesty of that. They want to invoke that in your mind, mm-hmm. right? That you will have a wonderful feeling as you feel yourself, you know, over time being elevated by spirit gravity, just like you feel when you watch those eagles, you know, catching that thermal and rising upward. Yep. You know. I got to mention, but real praying does attain reality. That, duh, it wouldn't be real praying if it. Right? You know, but they're reminding. Like I said, it's you know, they're reminding you that the literalness of spirit gravity. It's kind of a science, paragraph. You know, that's the whole point of using the real modifier, right? Is it's tied to reality now. You know, they just, you know, those simple, straightforward, factual statements is the point of that paragraph.
Genuine prayer adds to spiritual growth, modifies attitudes, and yields that satisfaction which comes from communion with divinity. It is a spontaneous outburst of God consciousness.
And that's a cool one. See, again, because... if there's no direct awareness at a God consciousness level for us, don't forget superconsciously it's there. Post Pentecost, everyone is engaged by the Spirit of Truth. Everyone has a thought adjuster. If you don't have a thought adjuster, you can't technically have God consciousness because you have to leverage off that thought adjuster to get that. So, but you have an adjuster. So superconsciously, at the top of everything, there literally is God consciousness. And you can have a spontaneous outburst directly from the shadow that God consciousness fact casts in your mind. Okay, so they're just reminding you of there's great potential here. Don't misinterpret that sentence like, oh, we all have God consciousness. No, that's not what that sentence is saying. You know, but again, it's and they're pointing out if the more you can clear prayer of the primitive stuff, the foolish stuff, the whatnot, so that it's more genuine, it actually can begin to benefit from these elements of grace, even literally God consciousness by grace, way up there in your superconscious domain.
God answers man's prayer by giving him an increased revelation of truth, an enhanced appreciation of beauty, and an augmented concept of goodness. Prayer is a subjective gesture, but it contacts with mighty objective realities and the spiritual level of human experience. It is a meaningful reach by the human for superhuman values. It is the most potent spiritual growth stimulus.
Okay, we kind of already were stressing that a little bit ago. Okay, this is, okay, it is the most potent. Okay, so nothing I'm saying, you know, changes that as I challenge more primitive forms of prayer. But I told you we'd get back to truth, beauty, and goodness. You remember we saw that in that list. Right. So this is where, you know, you start to understand how the God that you're praying to, who's changeless, who has no direct relationship to time and all this stuff, you know, well, how do I think about this properly? Because that would mean the only way he could answer prayer is if he basically answered all prayers before time began. He answered all prayers in advance. It's like, well, how could he do that? Well, like this. God answers man's prayer, okay, no matter what it is, by giving him an increased revelation of truth, an enhanced appreciation of beauty, and an augmented concept of goodness. He doesn't give you the parking space. He doesn't cure your relative's disease. Okay, this is the only answer to prayer, really. And he can set that up from the beginning. Right? He set up a system so that the moment that you supply the slightest favorable condition, boom, it's filled with an increased revelation of truth, an enhanced appreciation of beauty, and an augmented concept of goodness. And that's all you really need. And they get into this, even though we're not going to get to the final section, right? That's one of the main points in the final section is, I mean, the stuff you're immediately praying for, that's your job. Now, it may be the case that you kind of don't have the capacity and the filled capacity to succeed, but prayer can help. It's the most potent spiritual growth stimulus, right? You need that, you know, greater capacity, and you need it filled with something that so that you can solve these problems that it's your job to solve. They're not going to be solved for you by some magic guy, okay? you're going to solve them. And if you really don't have what it takes, you'll be given more. Because that's the answer to your prayer. You just need more wherewithal, okay? And then you can do it. And you will get it. But don't underestimate how much ability you have by grace to begin with that no one's using, okay? We could solve a lot of problems if we would just use the grace that we're given as a child of God. You know, forget about imagining what we could do if we were adults of God, okay? But if we would just use, you know, it's sad to record that so few persons, right, are really doing anything. And the fact that modern man is perplexed by the thought of talking things over with God and say, you know, he's abandoned regular praying, I kind of see goes in hand with the sad to record. And it's one of the ways that you can take delight in cultivating, being grown, is through prayer. Matter of fact, it's the most potent stimulus for that. So we need to pray. So that's just, you know, just, yeah, obviously you could reflect on that a lot, you know, just, and that can be difficult to face, that the only answer to any prayer is, you know, increased revelation of truth, etc. Okay. And obviously that would involve the spiritual technique thing being in play. I mean, that you're open to being grown, right? That there's a spiritual phenomenon that's happening. Yeah.
It's truth, beauty, and goodness. That's a triune,
right,
thing. Yeah. And then the rest of the paragraph primarily addresses spiritual levels of human experience.
Well, all those are a threefold spiritual fact. That's the existential triplet, remember.
Right, okay.
I mean, they're the associativity, individuality, and unity elements of an existential spiritual triplet.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Yeah.
That makes more sense.
Yeah.
How I was trying to rationalize it.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing to get a proper notion of what truth, beauty, and goodness refer to there. We've got all sorts of materialistic, you know, messes we've made out of those three things, too. You know, they deal with that in other parts of the book.
That's an interesting commentary about how we set that up before time.
Yes.
It's like, that's pretty clever.
Right. Right. He can make sure that it's, that you know, the response is instantaneous the moment that you open yourself up to being grown.
It has been and always will be.
Right. Yeah.
Interesting.
Right.
And that's probably in all levels of our existence.
That's all levels of our existence and every other being's existence, right? Yes.
Words are irrelevant to prayer. They are merely the intellectual channel in which the river of spiritual supplication may chance to flow. The word value of a prayer is purely auto-suggestive in private devotions and socio-suggestive in group devotions. God answers the soul's attitude, not the words.
Again, you know, the more of that psychologic stuff there, auto-suggestive, socio-suggestive. Notice even though, you know, he doesn't answer the words, words are irrelevant, okay. Okay, but don't think in dichotomy. It's like, okay, I have to absolutely stop saying words now. No, that's not. It's not saying that, right? It's just helping you to focus. Don't get all worried about. I need to be a professional prayer. Only a professional prayer can pick just the right words. Okay, it's just no. The words don't matter. Okay, you don't need to be a professional prayer. You don't need that priest who knows just the right word. You know, he knows that technical theologic term to stick in that sentence, and you don't need that. Okay, that's what it's trying to get you to not be tripping over your, your limited ability to be a wordsmith.
And he knows what you need even before you ask him anyway.
Right, he's already answered everyone's prayer before time began, because he knows exactly what you need. Right? You need that deity downreach the moment that you choose to be an upreach. Right? He will meet you instantaneously. He's already set that up. It will happen.
Prayer is not a technique of escape from conflict, but rather a stimulus to growth in the very face of conflict. Pray only for values, not things, for growth, not for gratification.
And again, you know, well, that last sentence, though, is still about the psychologic procedure. You know, so you don't, you know, but it has its place, improving that psychologic procedure, because, you know, it's about, you know, I want more values, not things. I want growth, not gratification. See, it's still about you, but nonetheless, you can improve the psychologic procedure part. And then the other thing is just, when you see the word conflict, you should have a thought. Oh, effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, and progress. All right, those eight steps to progress. Oh, progress, I like that. I'd like things to progress. I always like the progress angels. Okay, the only way to get there is through conflict. It's like, well, I'll find the courage to get up to conflict, but then what? How do I get to the next step? Oh, prayer helps me that. Right? It's a stimulus to growth in the very face of conflict. Right? So prayer will help you get to that next step after conflict, which is faith. Effort, struggle, conflict, faith. How do you go from conflict to faith? It seems like pretty different. All right, prayer helps with that step.
Okay. Value seems to play a big part in this book. The whole concept of values.
You're right, because
now
of course,
and in
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's so important to have a definition for the word value. Right. Yeah. Yeah, because again, it's literally a property of spirit substance, and the book is trying to get you to recognize the literalness of spirit apart from mind and matter, right? So values isn't just, you know, a notion, some fanciful notion, you know. You can think about it more literally and directly. Okay, so that there's just that tiny little thing, like I said, that we'll wrap up next time that goes through these conditions, you know, and like I said, I mean, we already kind of recognize what it must be from what they said about the only answers to prayer. The whole point is you're going to do it, okay? And then you just, you know, the only thing that God can do is if you supply these favorable conditions of synchronizing with the mother so that you can be grown, yeah, that's going to be the conditions of effective prayer, right? You supply those favorable conditions, you're grown, and then all the physical stuff you do, right? And that's the way it works. So we'll just go through those in detail next time. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.